Without a word, Jordan grabbed Simon's arm and hauled him into the living room. Letting go of him, he rooted around for the cordless phone until he found it. "Call her," he said, slapping the phone against Simon's chest. "Call Meyer and make sure she's all right." "But it might not be her." Simon stared down at the phone as the full horror of the situation buzzed around his brain like a ghoul buzzing around the outside of a house, begging to be let in. "Focus," he told himself. "Don't panic. It might be Isabel." "Oh, Jesus." Jordan glowered at him. "Do you have any other girlfriends? Do we have to make a list of names to call?" Simon yanked the phone away from him and turned away, punching in the number. Maya answered on the second ring.
"Hello?"
"Maya, it's Simon."
The friendliness went out of her voice.
"Oh. What do you want?"
"I just wanted to check in that you were okay," he said.
"I'm fine,"
she spoke stiffly.
"It's not like what was going on with us was all that serious. I'm not happy, but I'll live. You're still an ass, though."
"No,"
Simon said.
"I mean, I wanted to check that you were okay."
"Is this about Jordan?"
He could hear the tense anger when she said his name.
"Right. You guys went off together, didn't you? You're friends or something, right?
Well, you can tell him to stay away from me. In fact, that goes for the both of you."
She hung up. The dial tone buzzed down the phone line like an angry bee. Simon looked at Jordan.
"She's fine. She hates us both, but it really didn't sound like anything else was wrong."
"Fine," Jordan said tightly. "Call Isabel." It took two tries before Izzy picked up. Simon was nearly in a panic by the time a voice came down the line, sounding distracted and annoyed.
"Whoever this is, it had better be good."
Relief poured through his veins.
"Isabel, it's Simon."
"Oh, for God's sake, what do you want?"
"I just wanted to make sure you were okay."
"Oh.
What, I'm supposed to be devastated because you're a cheating, lying, two-timing son of a..."
"No."
This was really starting to wear on Simon's nerves.
"I meant, are you all right? You haven't been kidnapped or anything."
There was a long silence.
"Simon," Isabel said finally, "this is really, seriously, the stupid excuse for a whiny makeup call that I have ever, ever heard. What's wrong with you?"
"I'm not sure,"
Simon said, and hung up before she could hang up on him. He handed the phone to Jordan.
"She's fine, too."
"I don't get it." Jordan looked bewildered. "Who makes a threat like that if it's totally empty? I mean, it's so easy to check and find out it's a lie."
"They must think I'm stupid,"
Simon began, and then paused, a horrible thought dawning on him. He snatched the phone back from Jordan and started to dial with numb fingers.
"Who is it?" Jordan said. "Who are you calling?"
Clary's phone rang just as she turned the corner of 96th Street onto Riverside Drive. The rain seemed to have washed away the city's usual dirt. The sun shone down from a brilliant sky onto the bright green strip of the park running alongside the river, whose water looked nearly blue today. She dug into her bag for her phone, found it, and flipped it open. "Hello?" Simon's voice came down the line. "Oh, thank," he broke off. "Are you all right? You're not kidnapped or anything." "Kidnapped?" Clary peered up at the numbers of the buildings as she walked uptown. 220, 224. She wasn't entirely sure what she was looking for. Would it look like a church? Something else? Glamored to look like an abandoned lot? "Are you drunk or something?" "It's a little early for that." The relief in his voice was plain. "No, I got a weird note. Someone threatening to go after my girlfriend." "Which one?" "Hardy har." Simon did not sound amused. "I called Maya and Isabel already, and they're both fine. Then I thought of you. I mean, we spend a lot of time together. Someone might get the wrong idea, but now I don't know what to think." "I don't know." 232 Riverside Drive loomed up in front of Clary suddenly, a big square stone building with a pointed roof. It could have been a church at one point, she thought, though it didn't look much like one now. Maya and Isabel found out about each other last night, by the way. It wasn't pretty, Simon added. You were right about the playing with fire bit. Clary examined the facade of number 232. Most of the edifices lining the drive were expensive apartment buildings, with doormen in livery waiting inside. This one, though, had only a set of tall wooden doors with curved tops and old-fashioned-looking metal handles instead of doorknobs. Ooh, ouch. Sorry, Simon. Are either of them speaking to you? Not really. She took hold of one of the handles and pushed. The door slid open with a soft hissing noise. Clary dropped her voice. Maybe one of them left the note. It doesn't really seem like their style, said Simon, sounding genuinely puzzled. Do you think Jace would have done it? The sound of his name was like a punch to the stomach. Clary caught her breath and said, I really don't think he'd do that, even if he was angry. She drew the phone away from her ear. Peering around the half-open door, she could see what looked reassuringly like the inside of a normal church, a long aisle and flickering lights like candles. Surely it couldn't hurt just to take a peek inside. I have to go, Simon, she said. I'll call you later. She flipped her phone closed and stepped inside.
You really think it was a joke? Jordan was prowling up and down the apartment like a tiger pacing its cage at the zoo. I don't know. That seems like a really sick sort of a joke to me. I didn't say it wasn't sick. Simon glanced at the note. It lay on the coffee table, the block-printed letters clearly visible even at a distance. Just looking at it gave him a lurching feeling in his stomach, even though he knew it was meaningless. I'm just trying to think who might have sent it, and why. Maybe I should take the day off watching you and keep an eye on her, said Jordan. You know, just in case. I assume you're talking about Maya, said Simon. I know you mean well, but I really don't think she wants you around, in any capacity. Jordan's jaw tightened. I'd stay out of the way so she wouldn't see me. Well, you're still really into her, aren't you? I have a personal responsibility. Jordan sounded stiff. Whatever else I feel doesn't matter. You can do what you want, said Simon. But I think... The door buzzer sounded again. The two boys exchanged a single look before both bolting down the narrow hallway to the door. Jordan got there first. He grabbed for the coat rack that stood by the door, ripped the coats off it and flung the door wide open, the rack held above his head like a javelin. On the other side of the door was Jace. He blinked. Is that a coat rack? Jordan slammed the coat rack down on the ground and sighed. If you'd been a vampire, this would have been a lot more useful. Yes, said Jace. Well, you know, just someone with a lot of coats. Simon stuck his head around Jordan and said,
Sorry, we've had a stressful morning.
Yeah, well, said Jace, it's about to get more stressful. I came to bring you to the Institute, Simon. The Conclave wants to see you, and they don't like having to wait.
The moment the door of the Church of Talto shut behind Clary, she felt that she was in another world, the noise and bustle of New York City entirely shut out. The space inside the building was big and lofty, with high ceilings soaring above. There was a narrow aisle banked by rows of pews, and fat brown candles burned in sconces bolted along the walls. The interior seemed dimly lit to Clary, but perhaps that was just because she was used to the brightness of witchlight. She moved along the aisle, the tread of her sneakers soft against the dusty stone. It was odd, she thought. A church with no windows at all. At the end of the aisle, she reached the apse, where a set of stone steps led to a podium on which was displayed an altar. She blinked up at it, realizing what else was strange. There were no crosses in this church. Instead, there was an upright stone tablet on the altar, crowned by the carved figure of an owl. The words on the tablet read, For her house inclineth unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go unto her return again, neither take they hold of the paths of life. Clary blinked. She wasn't too familiar with the Bible. She certainly didn't have anything like Jace's near-perfect recall of large passages of it. But while that sounded religious, it was also an odd bit of text to feature in a church. She shivered and drew closer to the altar, where a large closed book had been left out. One of the pages seemed to be marked. When Clary reached to open the book, she realized that what she'd thought was a bookmark was a black-handled dagger carved with occult symbols. She'd seen pictures of these before in her textbooks. It was an athame, often used in demonic summoning rituals. Her stomach went cold, but she bent to scan the marked page anyway, determined to learn something, only to discover that it had been written in a cramped, stylized hand that would have been hard to decipher had the book been in English. It wasn't. It was in a sharp, spiky-looking alphabet that she was sure she'd never seen before. The words were below an illustration of what Clary recognized as a summoning circle, the kind of pattern warlocks traced on the ground before they enacted spells. The circles were meant to draw down and concentrate magical power. This one, splashed across the page in green ink, looked like two concentric circles with a square in the center of them. In the space between the circles, runes were scrawled. Clary didn't recognize them, but she could feel the language of the runes in her bones, and it made her shiver. Death and blood. She turned the page hastily and came on a group of illustrations that made her suck in her breath. It was a progression of pictures that started with the image of a woman with a bird perched on her left shoulder. The bird, possibly a raven, looked sinister and cunning. In the second picture, the bird was gone, and the woman was obviously pregnant. In the third image, the woman was lying on an altar, not unlike the one Clary was standing in front of now. A robed figure was standing in front of her, a jarringly modern-looking syringe in its hand. The syringe was full of dark red liquid. The woman clearly knew she was about to be injected with it, because she was screaming. In the last picture, the woman was sitting with a baby on her lap. The baby looked almost normal, except that its eyes were entirely black, without whites at all. The woman was looking down at her child with a look of terror. Clary felt the hairs on the back of her neck prickle. Her mother had been right. Someone was trying to make more babies like Jonathan. In fact, they already had. She stepped back from the altar. Every nerve in her body was screaming that there was something very wrong with this place. She didn't think she could spend another second here. Better to go outside and wait there for the cavalry to arrive. She might have discovered this clue on her own, but the result was way more than she could handle on her own. It was then that she heard the sound. A soft susurration, like a slow tide pulling back, that seemed to come from above her. She looked up, the athame gripped firmly in her hand, and stared. All around the upstairs gallery stood rows of silent figures. They wore what looked like gray tracksuits, sneakers, dull gray sweats, and zip-up tops with hoods pulled down over their faces. They were utterly motionless, their hands on the gallery railing staring down at her. At least, she assumed they were staring. Their faces were hidden entirely in shadow. She couldn't even tell if they were male or female. I'm sorry, she said. Her voice echoed loudly in the stone room. I didn't mean to intrude, or... There was no answer but silence. Silence like a weight. Clary's heart began to beat faster. I'll just go, then, she said, swallowing hard. She stepped forward, laid the athame on the altar, and turned to leave. She caught the scent on the air then. A split second before she turned, the familiar stench of rotting garbage. Between her and the door, rising up like a wall, was a nightmarish mishmash of scaled skin, blade-like teeth, and reaching claws. For the past 7 weeks, Clary had trained to face down a demon in battle, even a massive one. But now that it was actually happening, all she could do was scream. Chapter 11. Our Kind. The demon lunged for Clary, and she stopped screaming abruptly and flung herself backward over the altar, a perfect flip. And for one bizarre moment, she wished Jace had been there to see it. She hit the ground in a crouch, just as something struck the altar hard, making the stone vibrate. A howl sounded through the church. Clary scrambled to her knees and peered over the edge of the altar. The demon wasn't as big as she'd first thought, but it wasn't small either, about the size of a refrigerator, with three heads on swaying stalks. The heads were blind, with enormous gaping jaws from which ropes of greenish drool hung. The demon seemed to have smacked its leftmost head on the altar when it grabbed for her, because it was shaking the head back and forth as if trying to clear it. Clary glanced up wildly, but the track-suited figures were still where they had been before. None of them had moved. They seemed to be watching what was going on with a detached interest. She spun and looked behind her, but there appeared to be no exits from the church besides the door she'd come through, and the demon was currently blocking her path back to it. Realizing she was wasting precious seconds, she scrambled to her feet and grabbed for the athame. She yanked it off the altar and ducked back down just as the demon came for her again. She rolled to the side as a head, swaying on a thick stalk of neck, darted over the altar, its thick black tongue flicking out, searching for her. With a scream, she jammed the athame into the creature's neck once, then jerked it free, scrambling backward and out of the way. The thing screamed, its head rearing back, black blood spraying from the wound she'd made. But it wasn't a killing blow. Even as Clary watched, the wound began to heal, slowly, the demon's blackish-green flesh knitting together like fabric being sewed up. Her heart sank. Of course. The whole reason Shadowhunters use runed weapons was that the runes prevented demons from healing. She reached for the steely in her belt with her left hand and yanked it free just as the demon came for her again. She leaped to the side and threw herself painfully down the stairs, rolling until she fetched up against the first row of pews. The demon turned, lumbering a bit as it moved, and made for her again. Realizing she was still clutching both the steely and the dagger, in fact, the dagger had cut her as she had rolled, and blood was quickly staining the front of her jacket, she transferred the dagger to her left hand, the steely to her right, and with a desperate swiftness cut an Inkele rune into the athame's hilt. The other symbols on the hilt began to melt and run as the rune of angelic power took hold. Clary looked up. The demon was almost on her, its three heads reaching, their mouths gaping. Propelling herself to her feet, she drew her arm back and flung the dagger as hard as she could. To her great surprise, it struck the middle head right in the center of the skull, sinking in up to the hilt. The head thrashed as the demon screamed. Clary's heart lifted, and then the head simply dropped, hitting the ground with a sickening thud. The demon kept coming anyway, dragging the now dead head on its limp neck after it as it moved toward Clary. The sound of many footsteps came from above. Clary looked up. The track-suited figures were gone, the gallery empty. The sight was not reassuring. Her heart doing a wild tango in her chest, Clary turned and ran for the front door, but the demon was faster than she was. With a grunt of effort, it launched itself over her and landed in front of the doors, blocking her way out. Making a hissing noise, it moved toward her, its two living heads swaying, then rising, stretching to their full length in order to strike at her. Something flashed through the air, a darting flame of silvery gold. The demon's heads whipped around, the hissing rising to a scream, but it was too late. The silvery thing that encircled them pulled tight, and with a spray of blackish blood, its remaining two heads sheared away. Clary rolled out of the way as flying blood splattered her, searing her skin. Then she ducked her head as the headless body swayed, fell toward her, and was gone. As it was collapsing, the demon vanished, sucked back to its home dimension. Cleary raised her head cautiously. The front doors of the church were open, and in the entranceway stood Isabel, in boots and a black dress, her electrum whip in hand. She was winding it back slowly around her wrist, glancing around the church as she did so, her dark eyebrows drawn together in a curious frown. As her gaze fell on Clary, she grinned. "Damn, girl," she said. "What have you gotten yourself into now?"
The touch of the vampire servant's hands on Simon's skin was cold and light, like the touch of icy wings. He shuddered a little as they unwound the blindfold from around his head, their withered skin rough on his, before they stepped back, bowing as they retreated. He looked around, blinking. Moments ago, he had been standing in the sunlight on the corner of 78th Street and 2nd Avenue, enough of a distance from the Institute that he had judged it safe to use the grave dirt to contact Camille without arousing her suspicions. Now he was in a dimly lit room, quite large, with a smooth marble floor and elegant marble pillars holding up a high ceiling. Along the left wall ran a row of glass-fronted cubicles, each with a brass-lettered plaque hanging over it that read, "Teller." Another brass plaque on the wall proclaimed this to be the Douglas National Bank. Thick layers of dust padded the floor and the counters, where people had once stood to write out checks or withdrawal slips, and the brass-bound lamps that hung from the ceiling were coated with verdigris. In the center of the room was a high armchair, and in the chair sat Camille. Her silvery blonde hair was undone, and rained down over her shoulders like tinsel. Her beautiful face had been wiped clean of makeup, but her lips were still very red. In the dimness of the bank, they were almost the only color Simon could see.
"I would not normally agree to meet during sunlight hours, Daylighter," she said. "But since it is you, I have made an exception."
"Thank you."
He noticed no chair had been provided for him, so he continued awkwardly standing. If his heart still beat, he thought, it would have been pounding. When he had agreed to do this for the conclave, he had forgotten how much Camille scared him. Maybe it was illogical. What could she really do to him? But there it was.
"I suppose this means you have considered my offer," said Camille, "and that you agree to it."
"What makes you think I agree?"
Simon said, very much hoping that she wouldn't put down the fatuousness of the question to the fact he was stalling for time. She looked mildly impatient.
"You would hardly deliver in person the news that you had decided to refuse me. You would be afraid of my temper."
"Should I be afraid of your temper?"
Camille sat back in the wing chair, smiling. The chair was modern-looking and luxurious, unlike anything else in the abandoned bank. It must have been hauled here from somewhere else, probably by Camille's servants, who were currently standing off to each side like silent statues.
"Many are," she said, "but you have no reason to be. I am very pleased with you. Though you waited until the last moment to contact me, I sense you have made the right decision."
Simon's phone chose that minute to begin buzzing insistently. He jumped, feeling a trickle of cold sweat going down his back, then fished it hastily out of the pocket of his jacket.
"Sorry,"
he said, flipping it open. "Phone." Camille looked horrified.
"Do not answer that."
Simon began lifting the phone to his ear. As he did, he managed to hit the camera button several times with his finger.
"It'll just take a second. Simon."
He hit the send button, then quickly flipped the phone closed.
"Sorry, I didn't think."
Camille's chest was rising and falling with rage, despite the fact she didn't actually breathe.
"I demand more respect than that from my servants," she hissed. "You will never do that again, or..."
"Or what?"
Simon said.
"You can't hurt me any more than anyone else can. And I told you I wouldn't be a servant. You told me I'd be your partner."
He paused, letting just the right note of arrogance into his voice.
"Maybe I ought to reconsider my acceptance of your offer."
Camille's eyes darkened. "Oh, for God's sake, do not be a little fool."
"How can you say that word?"
Simon demanded. Camille raised delicate eyebrows.
"Which word? Are you annoyed that I called you a fool?"
"No. Well, yes, but that's not what I meant. You said, oh, for..."
He broke off, his voice cracking. He still couldn't say it. God.
Because I do not believe in him, silly boy, said Camille. And you still do. She tilted her head to the side, regarding him the way a bird might regard a worm on the sidewalk that it was considering eating.
I think perhaps it's time for a blood oath.
A blood oath? Simon wondered if he heard right.
I forget that your knowledge of the customs of our kind is so limited.
Camille shook her silvery head.
I will have you sign an oath, in blood, that you are loyal to me. It will prevent you from disobeying me in the future. Consider it a sort of prenuptial agreement.
She smiled, and he saw the glint of her fangs.
Come.
She snapped her fingers imperiously, and a minion scurried toward her, their gray heads bent. The first to reach her handed her something that looked like an old-fashioned glass pen, the kind with a whorled tip meant to catch and hold ink.
You will have to cut yourself and draw your own blood, said Camille. Normally, I would do it myself, but the mark prevents me. Therefore, we must improvise.
Simon hesitated. This was bad. Very bad. He knew enough about the supernatural world to know what oaths meant to downworlders. They were not just empty promises that could be broken. They truly bound the promiser, like virtual manacles. If he signed the oath, he really would be loyal to Camille. Possibly forever.
Come along, Camille said, a touch of impatience creeping into her voice. There is no need to dawdle.
Swallowing, Simon took a reluctant step forward, and then another. A servant stepped in front of him, blocking his way. He was holding out a knife to Simon, a wicked-looking thing with a needle blade. Simon took it and raised it above his wrist. Then he lowered it.
You know, he said, I really don't like pain very much. Or knives.
Do it, Camille growled.
There has to be some other way.
Camille rose from her chair, and Simon saw that her fangs were fully extended. She was truly enraged.
If you do not stop wasting my time.
There was a soft implosion, a sound like something enormous tearing down the middle. A great shimmering panel appeared against the opposite wall. Camille turned toward it, her lips parting in shock as she saw what it was. Simon knew she recognized it, just as he did. There was only one thing it could be. A portal, and through it were pouring at least a dozen shadow hunters.
Okay, said Isabel, putting away the first aid kit with a brisk gesture. They were in one of the Institute's many spare rooms, meant to house visiting Clave members. Each was plainly furnished with a bed, a dresser, and a wardrobe, and a small bathroom. And of course, each one had a first aid kit, with bandages, poultices, and even spare steelies included. You're pretty well a rot sit up. But it's going to take a little while for some of those bruises to fade. And these. She ran her hand over the burn marks on Clary's forearm where the demon blood had splashed her. Probably won't go away totally till tomorrow. If you rest, they'll heal faster, though. That's fine. Thanks, Isabel. Clary looked down at her hands. There were bandages around the right one, and her shirt was still torn and blood-stained, though Izzy's runes had healed the cuts beneath. She supposed she could have done the erratzes herself, but it was nice to have someone take care of her, and Izzy, while not the warmest person Clary knew, could be capable and kind when she felt like it. And thanks for showing up, and you know, saving my life from whatever that was. A Hydra demon. I told you. They have a lot of heads, but they're pretty dumb. And you weren't doing such a bad job with it before I showed up. I like what you did with the Athame. Good thinking under pressure. That's as much a part of being a shadow hunter as learning how to punch holes in things. Isabel flopped down onto the bed next to Clary and sighed. I should probably go look up what I can find about the Church of Talto before the Conclave gets back. Maybe it'll help us figure out what's going on. The hospital stuff. The babies. She shuddered. I don't like it. Clary had told Isabel as much as she could about why she'd been at the church, even about the demon baby at the hospital, though she'd pretended she was the one who'd been suspicious and had kept her mother out of the story. Isabel had looked sick when Clary had described the way the baby had looked exactly like a normal baby, except for its open black eyes and the little claws it had instead of hands. I think they were trying to make another baby like my brother.